Welcome to Building a Powerful Left in the United States, live from the Left Forum. I'm going to call this show the Give the People What They Want show. You're going to hear in a few minutes Cornel West's speech from last night's plenary at the Left Forum. And following that, you're going to hear another incredible speech from the plenary, introduced by economist Richard Wolff. We'll hear the great British journalist Paul Mason talk about all of the populist uprisings that have been taking place across the world and in the United States over these past couple of months. Interspersed, we're going to hear the words of a few of the youth attending the conference on their vision for building a powerful left in the United States. And we'll also hear radical poet Josh Clover, who I met up with last night at the Verso Books Party that's thrown every year during the Left Forum here in New York City. And at the end of the hour, we'll hear from Walda Katz Fishman and Jerome Scott. They're here at the Left Forum, but we'll actually be talking about another radical forum that takes place in the United States, the U.S. Social Forum, its relationship to the Left Forum and the building of a left in the United States. Now, as I said a moment ago, this is the Give the People What They Want installment of the show, because while we've done amazing interviews here at the Left Forum, which you'll be hearing tomorrow and on other shows of building a powerful left in the United States, really nothing can possibly match the drama, intensity, and brilliance of some of the speeches at yesterday's plenary. So up next, Giving the People What They Want, Cornel West at last night's Left Forum opening plenary.
Thank you so very much. What a blessing, what an honor, and real privilege to be here. Left Forum 2011, and something is happening not just in the midst of the American Empire in Wisconsin. Something is happening in the northern section of Africa, in the Middle East. Latin America had beat us there, and lo and behold, in other corners of the globe. Let's give everyday people who have contributed to the radical democratic awakening a hand. That's what we're here for. That's what solidarity is about. Yes, those Sly Stone call everyday people straighten their backs up. And Brother Martin used to say, anytime everyday people straighten their backs up, they're going somewhere, because folk can't ride your back unless it's bent. And it's been bent for too long, much, much too long. We talk about politics of solidarity, that we're not just talking about the present. We need to bring together the three dimensions of time, the past, the present, and the future. When I think of solidarity, I want to be in solidarity with Martin Luther King Jr. I want to be in solidarity with Paul Robeson. I want to be in solidarity with Norman Thomas, Muriel Rukeyser, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, Philip Berrigan. Solidarity has to do with those in the past who are wrestling with the same question that we are wrestling is, which is, what does it mean to be a leftist? What does it mean to be progressive? Do we really have the courage to engage on a quest for the truth, understanding that the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak? And when you allow suffering to speak, all of a sudden, those France Fanon called the wretched of the earth begin to raise their voices. Poor people, working people, those wrestling with white supremacy and male supremacy, those wrestling with homophobia, those wrestling with imperial subjugation. They could be in Latin America, Asia, Africa. They can be in the Middle East. They can be in Central America, allowing their voices to be heard. Why? Because their humanity has been rendered invisible. Oftentimes, they have been viewed as superfluous people who do not matter, who do not count. And to be a leftist in the 19th century, the 20th century, or the 21st century is to say we are in solidarity with, namely, we just don't work alongside. We actually love those brothers and sisters. We care for those brothers and sisters. We don't care what color they are, black, red, yellow, brown, or whatever. And we're going down fighting because we're concerned about their humanity. We want them to live lives in such a way that they can flower and flourish. And isn't it something that to believe that is to be radical? Can you imagine what the powers that be must be like to believe something so simple as that? But that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with beginning with the catastrophic. To be a leftist is to begin with the catastrophic. that to begin with those persons who are dominated, subjugated, devalued, demeaned, and marginalized. And to look at the world through their lens. And that means that we cut radically against the grain in the last 40 years, especially in the American empire, where we have been told lies. Unfettered markets generating self-sufficiency, prosperity, and justice is a lie. White supremacy is a lie. Male supremacy is a lie. Homophobia is a lie. Anti-Semitism is a lie. Anti-Arab racism is a lie. Anti-Islamic sensibility is a lie. We simply say we want to stand for the truth. Small t, we recognize we're all cracked vessels. We make fallible claims, but somebody's right and somebody's wrong about this. And in addition to that, it is to say that we attempt to be courageous because we live in catastrophic times, and no doubt, our brothers and sisters in Japan, deep solidarity, you see. The children locked into human slavery, the women dealing with sexual violence, the gay brothers and lesbian sisters spit on in so many contexts. Black folk in America, in Central America, in Latin America still taught to hate themselves and believe they have less intelligence and less beauty. That's ugly. That's a lie that hurts. It hurts deeply. And that's when you talk about being a leftist, you're talking about being a certain kind of human being. Namely, a courageous human being. And we've been living in catatonic times alongside catastrophic times because there's so much sleepwalking going on. The numbing that has taken place, the indifference toward people, especially poor people and working people, with greed running amok at the top, Wall Street oligarchs looting not just the public treasury, but the the shadowy financial system generating billions of dollars when 21% of America's children of all colors living in poverty and 38% are brown. And let us never forget our red brothers and sisters, our indigenous brothers and sisters. They don't need to be in the room for us to talk about their suffering. It's their babies and their land that was dispossessed. 1492 was the beginning of World War I for them, and it's been continuous ever since. That's a perspective to understand what it is to create an American democratic experiment in all of its nobility. Now, there are some noble elements to American democracy. I would be the first to say so. But there's some vicious, imperial, racist, sexist, homophobic, classist elements too. And we have to be honest about it. And we haven't had enough people to be courageous. Why? Because after the death of Martin in 68, and after the repression of the social movements in the 60s and 70s, feminist and anti-homophobic and racial and class movements, so many folk caved in and decided they'd rather be comfortable than free. They'd rather be well-adjusted to injustice and well-adapted to indifference than really be in solidarity with those who came before, the great forefathers and foremothers of all colors who said, we want to be courageous in our quest for truth, allowing suffering to speak, and in our deep love and care for those folk catching hell. And one of the challenges is, how do we pass this on to the younger generation? We have got to highlight young people. Why? Because it's the young folk who have been in the vanguard in Northern Africa in the last few weeks, who have been willing to sacrifice to live and die for some grand democratic ideal in the face of U.S.-backed tyrannies. It's been the young folk who are beginning now to awaken. And the question becomes, how do we pass it on? Well, the first thing you do is Sankofa. You look back and you're in solidarity with the Daniel Singers, the Michael Harringtons. I know Stanley Rana was still around, but he's an older brother now. Steve Broner's still around, he's an older brother now, yes. Barbara Ann Reich, still going strong, but with solidarity with Sister Barbara, 35 years of struggle together. Why? Because when we look at their examples, we see people who are rare these days, which is what? They will not sell themselves for the highest bidder. They won't sell themselves for a mess of pottage. They refuse to be sold. And everybody these days is up for sale. Nearly everybody's up for sale. That's the difference of the younger generation vis-a-vis when I was coming along. When I looked and saw Huey Newton, saw Bob Avakian and some other folk, whether I agreed with them or not ideologically, I knew they could never sell out. They had integrity. They had a willingness to sacrifice. They had vision. They were concerned about what they were talking about. These days, it's hard to find that in a younger generation, so hungry for it. They're so thirsty for it. What is all this talk about leftist discourse? How do you translate it into lived experience? How does it become real in my life? That's the question of the younger generation. And I said, you can listen to a little Curtis Mayfield and listen to some Bob Dylan. Listen to a little Bruce Springsteen. Listen to a little Aretha, her birthday is on Monday. Why? Because yes, it's in the culture, it's in the arts, it's in the music that so many of our young folk are going to really be radicalized. And then they're able to engage in those subtle analysis of American empire and the military overreach and the 850 military branches around the world and a ship in every ocean and why it is that Latin America and Brazil and why it is in Venezuela and why it is in India and China presents the challenge to the American empire and why it is that the Wall Street oligarchs and the corporate elites are sucking so much of the blood of American democracy in such a way that more and more people are just useless, superfluous, and they don't care, and they think they can get away with it because there's been no resistance of large scale, and they think in the end that chickens don't come home to roost, that you don't reap what you sow, that sooner or later what's in the wash gonna come out in the rinse. And we simply say it left form, we stand for the truth, we stand for justice. No lie can live forever, no set of lies can live forever. And if you think that everyday people are simply going to take it, generation after generation, echoes of the ninth thesis of Walter Benjamin when he talked about the catastrophe and the piling of wreckage upon wreckage of every generation. Look at the black community. Look at the brown community in New York City. Levels of unemployment, 30 and 40% for 45 years. And lo and behold, people start going, oh, we might have a new permanent underclass. Look again. It's already been here. Look again. They've been suffering all that time. Look again. We can be in solidarity at the deepest level if we understand that we need our analysis broader, but most importantly, our courage in place that weds our hearts and our minds, but also our bodies. Our bodies. And that's what young folk are looking for. And that's what's exciting about the left forum of 2011. Because we can't overlook the challenge of the younger generation connecting past, present, and future, connecting the catastrophic, the catatonic, and now the catalyst. Yes, and that's what we see in Madison. That's what we see in Columbus, Ohio. That's what we see in New York. We're going to see it April the 5th here in the teach-in with Sister Frances, Fox Piven, and others. A catalyst is setting in. And those of us who've been at it for a long time, I'm damn near 60 years old now. Should have been dead a long time ago. All the work we've been doing. 150 lectures every year for 32 years. I should have dropped dead a long time ago. But I'm still going. Why? Because now a new day could be emerging. It could be emerging. Left Forum will be part of it. Let us see, but not just here in the American empire, in the Middle East. Be working poor in Israel, it could be our Palestinian brothers and sisters under Israeli occupation. In Latin America, against the oligarchs who've been ruling for so long, in Asia, in India, in Indonesia, and look at all of the connections now between American imperial elites and the autocrats in the so-called Arab world, but it's really North Africa and some of them Arab speaking. And what do we have? We got Obama in the White House. charismatic version of American exceptionalism with Keynesian neoliberalism at home and liberal neoconservatism abroad. That's what he is. He's the friendly face of the American empire. He's siding too much with the powerful. He's siding with the Wall Street oligarchs. He gave us democratic rhetoric in the campaign, but when it came time for policy, where was Jamal and Letitia? Where was Juan and where was Betty? The everyday people in terms of his tilt. He said, oh, Brother West, you supported the brother. Yes, I did. I supported him, you did too. I said I was a critical supporter. I wanted to bring the age of Reagan to a close. And McCain and Palin was a catastrophic response to catastrophe. But we understand when the empire's in decline, the culture's in decay, and the political system is broken. The system's been colonized by both the Wall Street oligarchs and the corporate elites. And the culture is full of decay with weapons of mass distraction. Nobody wants to zero in on the most crucial issues enough. But awakening is taking place. Left Forum is an integral part of that. Let us do our role. What a blessing to be here tonight.
Hi, my name is Kevin. I'm a school teacher, public school teacher here in New York City. I'm originally from Wisconsin. I'm 28 years old. I'm here at the Left Forum today and all weekend to participate in a conference about building a fighting left in the United States. I think a fighting left can take a lot of lessons from the struggles in Madison, where workers have discovered their own power and through an occupation of the Capitol building, through job actions, have put working people on the agenda and raised the question of working class politics for the first time in over 30 years. We're trying to take some of that spirit here in New York. We're organizing on March 24th, the Day of Rage Against Budget Cuts. Unlike Wisconsin, which has a Tea Party Republican governor bringing about very harsh cuts on the budget and attacks on unions, we have a Democrat, Andrew Cuomo, who's trying to do very similar measures here. So for me as a public school teacher, this would deeply affect my working life, and it's important for us to take some lessons from the Midwest and from the struggles that are emerging in Michigan, Missouri, Indiana, and try to build that same kind of movement here.
Hi, my name's Jeremy Sawyer. I'm a school psychologist here in New York City Public Schools. And I guess, you know, one of the things I see is the attack on not only public education, but specifically on special education, which is what I work in. And, you know, special education rights for people with disabilities came out of the civil rights movements of the 60s and 70s. And I really feel like we're going to have to rebuild movements like that. Within our unions, we're going to have to, the rank and file is going to have to organize itself and force the union leaders to take up questions of social justice, questions of racism, you know, fight for disabilities for the most vulnerable segments of our population. You know, I think it says a lot about our society that they're going after the most vulnerable layers. And I absolutely think that, you know, everyone who went to Madison and who's coming back here and sharing the lessons, like, that's been totally inspirational for all of us in New York and all the teachers here. So from the Middle East to Wisconsin to New York, we got to continue that fight and increase our organization.
My name is Adriano Contreras. I'm 25 years old. I'm a documentary filmmaker here in New York City. And I think really what's the key thing for people on the left today is for them to find organization, to be organized. If anyone were to look at what, like, Egypt 3 months ago, the idea of, like, the apathetic people sort of, I think, plagues the left right now in certain sectors. And I think we need to throw that out the window. And people should just get organized, because the idea that you can't organize people who are apathetic is just bogus. People came into the streets in Egypt by the millions because they saw that people, when they get together and fight, can win so much more.
Hi, I'm Courtney. I'm 27 years old. I'm a student at CUNY Queens College here in New York City, and I've been doing a lot of the organizing for the March 24th Day of Rage Against the Budget Cuts, and I kind of see that as New York's Wisconsin and New York's Egypt. I hope that that's the potential of it. The unions have been mobilizing their memberships, all of the CUNY campuses, NYU, Pace University, Borough of Manhattan Community College are all mobilizing their students, and it's shaping up to be a real show of workers' and students' power to be able to fight back against the budget cuts that have been coming down on us and back, you know, before the kind of 30 years of neoliberal onslaught, CUNY campuses used to be free. And that's one of the things that we're fighting for, again, is for free tuition and to be able to keep our Pell and TAP grant financial aid, because that's one of the only ways that working class students can afford to go to college. So I think that that's one of our most important demands, and it's great to have union and community backing on that too.
Our next speaker is Paul Mason. He is the economics editor of the BBC's flagship current affairs program, Newsnight, and appears frequently on BBC's World News America. He has covered globalization and social justice stories from locations around the world, including Latin America, Africa, and China. His book, Live Working, Die Fighting, was longlisted on the Guardian First Book Award. As a measure of our own commitment here to internationalism, it is a pleasure to welcome a guest from the BBC.
Hey, if you're going to do your internationalism, I think, you know, I'm inviting a white guy from England. You could do better. As a public service journalist, I'm required not to have public political opinions. And for the right to go and interview loyally and inquisitively, you know, the opposite of this, something like a Tea Party gathering, I guard that jealously. So I'm obliged to say to you, don't take it personally when I say my presence here is not designed to indicate support for any left party or program in America. But I mean, as a labor historian, my book is a narrative history of the global labor movement, and with comparisons to now, it is fascinating to watch a piece of labor history unfolding. Now, we are in the middle of a wave of discontent. In some countries, revolutions. In some countries, social upheavals. Rick listed them. In others, the revival of student and labor activism on levels not seen for a generation. In my profession, we've struggled to understand this. I've covered the strikes and protests in London, in southern Europe, the crash and burn of a party that ruled Ireland for 90 years. I've become, for those who managed to watch British TV, something of an anti-Glenn Beck, in the sense that, though I haven't been to Egypt, my job is to go in the studio with a map of the Middle East and explain to people things about why contagion happens. My bosses asked me, quite suddenly, because they'd suddenly got a big interview with somebody about the whole revolutionary wave about a month ago, Paul, please come in immediately and start making a program about the process of revolutionary contagion. I said to them, where do you want to do the pieces to camera? My producer said, well, the British Museum turned us down, so why don't we go to Karl Marx's flat in Dean Street, so, and take a globe and hang out of the window there. So look, I have sat with mainstream journalists, old hands of the Cold War, who are no friends of gatherings like this or your agenda, and we have pondered the question, is this February 1917, together in our newsroom, the newsroom of a major, serious, global network. Now, there are, of course, parallels with many revolutionary situations and waves. There are elements of 1848 in this for sure. There are echoes of 1917 in Egypt already, as the workers are finally allowed to carry out their economic struggles, and as the Democrats who made that revolution start asking themselves what that one chant for social justice would actually mean. There are elements of May 68 in what's happening to the students. But I want to try and focus on what is new in the situation. Let's establish what we're talking about. In July 2009, the youth of Iran rose up in the green wave against the theft of the election. That was called the... It'll be a long list if you carry on clapping. In December, it was called a Twitter revolution. In December 2009, there was a youth uprising in Greece against the police killing of a young protester. All the rest of the next year has been a cycle of general strikes, Molotov cocktails, political crisis in Greece, part of the Eurozone, for now. By October 2010, all over France, French students joined workers on the streets and youth from the banlieue, youth from the projects, on the streets together for what? Well, this is my favourite press cutting of the last 12 months. Associated Press, 19th of October 2010. Masked youths, clad in black, torched cars, smashed storefronts, and threw up roadblocks Tuesday, clashing with riot police across France as protests over raising the retirement age to 62 took a radical turn. Then, in November, British student demos and occupations began, trashing the party HQ of the Conservatives, leading to 60 colleges, including all the big-name global universities, the Harvard and Yale equivalents and Princeton equivalents, you know, Cambridge, LSE, UCL, occupied. And then Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in a small town in Tunisia, and you don't need to be told the rest. It doesn't need to be added, Madison. Today, there are Saudi and Qatari tanks on the streets of Bahrain. There is an escalating military situation over Libya. There is an escalating diplomatic situation among Shia in the Middle East about the Bahraini crackdown, so a tiny country has a potentially detonating effect. There are live fire clashes on the streets of Yemen. There are in Syria, three towns today. Those of you who are not on like me and Laura, on this perpetual news cycle, is it only today that Syria blew up with three towns experiencing the shooting of protesters? Now, my job is to try and explain this. And in the story, I've noticed three things happening that I think are new, and I'm going to try and talk about them. The demographics and the technology and the behavior. Okay, in demographics, Rick said it. You've got youth without a future. In North Africa, you've got 20% youth unemployment, but in countries where two-thirds of the population are below the age of 30. In Europe, and for a layer in the Middle East, a crucial layer that helped start these revolutions, you have a more specific thing. That is the graduate without a future. For both sets of people, the economic crisis that began with Lehman Brothers was not just some downturn, not just a blip, as the economic person within the US Embassy in London assured me at the time. It has turned the entire curve of their life upside down. Their curve was upwards. Do this, you'll get a better life. Now, they can only see their lives getting worse than those of their parents. And just to add, both in North Africa and in peripheral Europe, these economic crises raise crises of political legitimacy, obviously in a dictatorship. But also, remember, southern Europe is taking the medicine dictated by Germany. When I reported from Athens, some of my viewers were shocked to hear me say that if you go into the mountains and small towns of Greece, you will meet people who lived under German occupation. Now, whatever you think your position on World War II is and whatever your nationality, you have to understand what it is for them to lose their pensions because Germany says so. Watch what happens. Now, for those who are my age, this idea of a graduate without a future or a graduate workforce that suddenly faces a doom scenario can be easily misunderstood. In my generation, students had a liberal education. We didn't pay for our education. We had a lot of time. We didn't have to work, and we got jobs. Now, students are a key part of the workforce. Their casual labour keeps the coffee bars going, the cocktail bars going. They are part of an education industry, some tens of billions of dollars worth in the world. A this, you get this commodity called a degree or a higher degree. They're crucial to the financial system. Citigroup alone made $200 million from its student loan book in 2007. They're tested to within an inch of their lives every month, every year. The jobs they get are like indentured labor. Wow, you get a job for a consultancy firm. I only have to stay with them for 3 years. Their life was going to be better, and now it looks like it's going to be worse. It's clear that the austerity programs that are being heaped on top of the original recession that followed Lehman, and in this regard, Madison is a harbinger for you. We've already got it in Europe, and the rest of the world has this, the austerity. We're finding three sets of people who it's affecting. This graduate workforce and the students, the urban poor, and the organized working class. But what's new? Well, 20 years of neoliberalism have taught these people, all three sets of them, to be individualistic, to have what the sociologist Richard Sennett calls weak ties to each other, to organizations, weak ties to their organizations, even weak ties to their own work, their own company. It created neoliberalism, as Sennett writes, an ideal worker who he describes like this, a self oriented to the short term, focused on potential ability rather than actual skill, willing to abandon past experience, with weak institutional loyalty, low levels of trust, and high levels of anxiety about their own potential uselessness as capitalism changes. They are the opposite of the worker in the Weberian sociological pyramid, in the hierarchy diagram. They work in networked organizations. Their work is networked. Their leisure is networked. They've begun to struggle using networks. Of course, each country has its own mix. The size of the urban poor, the radicalism of the student movement differs in every country. But I think what I've noticed as I've reported on this is that there, in many of the countries, the social mix is now a lot more like that which created the Paris Commune, with a strong urban poor, a weaker organized labor, and a radicalized intelligentsia than, for example, Flint, Michigan in 1937. Michigan. Either way, it all calls to mind for me the warning of Taine, the historian of the French Revolution. I summarize. He said, when it comes to revolutions, don't just worry about the poor, worry about poor lawyers. Because in the student, the lawyer, the civil servant, the doctor, the classics professor, starving in their garret, in their unattended waiting room, there's a potential Jacobin, says Taine. Well, now, in every garret, there is a laptop. And this is where technology comes in. Of course, you'll be sick already of this debate. Is it social? Was it the Facebook revolution? The Egyptian revolutionaries think it's an insult to call it a Facebook revolution. When they switched off the internet, they simply went onto the streets more. But I stand on the side that says these movements are being expressed through and created by a new technological reality. But it's not just or even primarily social media. Of course, Twitter, Facebook, YFrog allow protesters to mobilize quickly, to present to the mainstream media, people like me, undeniable evidence instantly, which allows us all to become witnesses, again, almost instantly, to acts of resistance and repression. Who can forget the placard in Tahrir Square? Mubarak, please go, my arms are tired. Who can forget on YouTube the bunch of older men in Tahrir Square chanting, Condoleezza, Condoleezza, please give Mubarak a visa. They didn't quite caught up with the career path of Condoleezza, but you could see what they were trying to say. But it's a lot of other things. It's mobile telephony. It's mainstream media leverage. It's the sharing of cultural memes of resistance, the snatches of songs, the snatches of poetry, poetry chanted from the rooftops of Tehran during the crisis when you can't go on the streets. It's the constant photographing on cell phones which says to soldiers and policemen, you will end up at the International Criminal Court. I add, if your country has signed the treaty which represents it. Now, in the debate that's broken out, Malcolm Gladwell famously says what's wrong with social networking is that it can only achieve small things. It can annoy, embarrass, but it couldn't have achieved what the civil rights movement achieved. And for that, you need hierarchy to confront hierarchy. And I'm not hostile to that, but I think it's more complex. I think if you study in detail what the April 6th movement did, they didn't just do social networking. They had a plan, a strategy borrowed from the Gene Sharp's famous strategy guide for nonviolent revolution. They had a network, if you read the interviews, of cells, quite similar to the way guerrilla movements organize. 50 people with one leader knows the other leaders, but nobody else does. What they'd learned, though, from the 20th century, was to try, in the beginning, to inure themselves to the hierarchical dangers of nationalism, of Stalinism, of Islamism, because they had read more than the generation I came from. They had, in a way, as Foucault once said to Gilles Deleuze, you know, we took 100 years to understand class. We took to the 19th century to understand class, but it's taken us another 100 years to understand power. If you go to a British student occupation, the books on the floor are Foucault, Deleuze, obviously Hart, Negri, Chomsky. Those ideas were not formulated in the student occupations of my early 20s. In addition, what they learned practically from the anarchist and eco-warrior tradition was the idea of creating spaces, and that space is a conquest. The Tahrir Square organizers had learned this, that many of them had experience of the Western student and eco-movement. And here, I think they've begun to do what the syndicalists did, from Lawrence, Massachusetts, to Buenos Aires, to Welsh coal mines. They started to recognize that between reform and revolution, there is another space for the expanded control over your own life, over place, over culture, over personal relationships. The British students became so addicted to occupying that even after the law was passed, they carried on occupying. One said, after that vote was taken, great, my house is crap anyway. I'd rather live in an occupation than in a student hovel. But above all, they use these methods that drive union organizers and left group organizers mad, the lack of commitment, the constant febrility of what they do. I think another product of the new technological reality is that propaganda is beginning to become highly flammable, highly hard to make stick. Yes, you get spin doctors on Twitter. Yes, you get outright disinformation. But the truth acts like white blood cells, and it is more effective in a social media than in a mainstream media. Mainstream media is good at creating bubbles where people can believe a partial version of the truth. Social media is good at popping the bubble. That's all I claim for it, but I think you have to see it, and when you've seen it used, it is an interesting part of the new reality. Finally, I think the technology is making the protests, and that, as it were, the vibe, which you described, Lord, is making the protests for the first time in 20 years seem more modern than the methods of those who oppose them. Whereas the old methods, the pure strike, the pure student demo, the pure intellectual thing, the pure riot by the oppressed, always were able to be pigeonholed. Finally, I'm going to talk about, just for 1 minute, behavior. André Gortz is probably not the most popular person to bring up in the middle of American labor's greatest upsurge for 20 years, but he did write a book called Farewell to the Working Class. I don't agree with the thesis, but what he describes in terms of a revolution is very interesting. He says it's first and foremost the irreversible destruction of the machinery of domination. It implies a form of collective practice capable of bypassing and superseding it, that machinery, through the development of an alternative network of relations. And think this is what we're seeing from Tehran to Madison, is the development of alternative networks of relations and means of struggle that represent the fact that the swarm, the disorganized mass, organized through networks, can sometimes, and up to a point, defeat the hierarchy. But of course it begs the question, where do you go when the hierarchy fights back? And this is the next phase, which I don't offer any conclusions on because my job is to simply report it. There's a host of caveats. Some places they can switch the internet off. Some places the powerful are so strong because they have mass support. Iran, Ahmadinejad has the besieged militia, the poor. China, the Communist Party is a 60 million strong network. It functions like a network. But I want to finish because I think these words do describe what is happening, with the words of one of the American student protesters. They'd gone into their college and set up a store, and the authorities didn't like it and called the cops. And the cops came to arrest somebody, so the students sat down around the police car. And one young guy, 21 years old, took off his shoes and stood on top of the police car and made a speech and began a mass meeting that lasted for 7 days. And later, he described what he'd felt. The act of sitting around the police car, of getting up on the car and starting to speak, of physically structuring the possibility of a community, he said. All of a sudden, there's a self-justifying factor to it. In a way, once it's been established, there might be other reasons for sitting around the police car than keeping it from moving. Namely, participating in the community. I have never experienced that nearly so strong as around the police car. Now, those are the words of Mario Savio. And the act I'm describing was in Berkeley in 1964. And you may have thought, and my colleagues in my profession may have thought, that such sentiments, such idealism, such ability to create the sudden community out of the empty space of isolated individuals, to achieve change through non-violence and through eloquence, you may have thought that the days of all that were gone. Well, they're back.
This is Alan Minsky, the series Building a Powerful Left in the United States, and we are here at the red carpet for the Verso Books Loft Party, an annual event at the Left Forum here in Dumbo in Brooklyn. And I am here with Josh Clover, a poet and man about town and man about the country. And I'm here to ask Josh Clover, the folks across the very pure and organic body of water that is right outside the windows here, the East River in Lower Manhattan, the people who run Finance Capital, set the table for the world in terms of a revitalization of a classical left. We're 3 years after the fact, and finally we see some stirrings within the domestic United States of significant popular mobilizations that fit a classic left model, of course referring to Wisconsin. Very complex society. Your work certainly reflects the complexity of contemporary American society. Do you think it's possible for there to be a powerful left that could emerge in the near future in the United States?
Well, I think you framed the question quite accurately. It's possible, although we would have to debate what you mean by near. My sense of the scope of these matters is fairly patient. But I think that it's not clear to me that the left, as we currently understand it, has within its capacity right now the ability to build a strong and broad movement. But I think that capital, as you suggest, has within its power the capacity to build a strong left, which is to say, I think that 3 years ago was more or less a warm-up or an introduction to a long and ongoing problem, which is going to become more and more apparent that there's no not taking sides, there's no watching the tides rise and fall, there's in fact a real directionality and ongoing catastrophe, and that, I believe, will build a quite powerful left. Now, my real hope is that the struggles within the left, the often described as internecine struggles that tend to divide between sort of micro-parties within the left, those are powerful right now and they're a challenge. They're a real challenge. But my belief is this rising tide of catastrophe will lead to a pressure to organize, and we'll find a way to start organizing as a group, and these small differences will vanish, and we'll start to see a fairly coherent or at least unified left. My guess is within the next 5 to 10 years, I hope that we can all make it through that period, which is not going to be, I think, a pleasant time for the U.S., much less for the rest of the globe.
Josh, can you tell people a little bit about what you're working on? I know I saw an article yours on The Nation. Do you have a website? Where is your latest book published?
Well, I'm currently working on a book on finance, capital, and poetry, but I have more work coming out in The Nation, reviewing books about the financial crisis. I have a substantial essay review coming out in the first edition of the Los Angeles Review of Books, which will come into being sometime in the next month or so. So a lengthy piece there, which in fact reviews quite a few Verso books, speaking of this party, and tries to take the measure of where we are now in this financial crisis and how we might see the unfolding of various scenarios for a rejiggering of the geopolitical formations.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
This is Alan Minsky, and you're listening to Building a Powerful Left in the United States, live from the Left Forum. Right now I'm joined by Jerome Scott and Walda Katz Fishman. Jerome Scott is the former director for Project South, the Institute for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide. He is a member of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America and sits on the National Planning Committee for the United States Social Forum.
Walda Katz Fishman is a sociologist at Howard University. She also was on the board for Project South and is also on the National Planning Committee for the United States Social Forum. So this is live from the Left Forum, but the U.S. Social Forum, which most recently took place in Detroit last summer, is also a large, large collection of people who come together and talk about strategies for social transformation in the spirit of the political left. Let's have listeners hear from both of you about how you see the U.S. Social Forum and the U.S. Social Forum movement contributing to building a more powerful left in the United States. And why don't we start with you, Jerome?
Yes. First of all, thank you for having us. I think the fundamental thing that the U.S. Social Forum brings to the table is its ability to really provide for the space for people from all various different fronts of struggle to come together and discuss how the struggle is developing, to discuss tactics and strategy, you know, and to really get to know both people who are in similar fronts of struggle or the same front of struggle around the country, and to see how much activity is really going on around this country to eliminate this notion that a lot of us have sometimes, is that we must be the only ones struggling, particularly on the progressive or left side of things. I think that's one of the really important things that the U.S. Social Forum offers. The other thing I think it offers is this ability to come together and have some more theoretical kinds of discussions about what are we fighting for? I mean, what is our vision of the future? And, you know, how can we utilize, is our strategies connected to that vision? And are our strategies working to move us toward a vision of this new world that we're fighting for? So I think those two things are very important. And the last thing that I wanted to contribute to that is this is all in the backdrop of understanding that we need a huge movement in this country if we're going to really have the kind of fundamental change that we need. You know, not Band-Aids on a deteriorating capitalist society, but really the transformation of capitalism itself. And so it's going to take the kind of people that the U.S. Social Forum is able to bring together to really create the basis for this huge movement that it's going to take to fundamentally change this country. And so I think the U.S. Social Forum is very important.
And Walda Katz Fishman, first off, if you want to add anything to what Jerome said or your take on the role of the U.S. Social Forum in building a powerful, socially transformative social justice movement in the United States, but also maybe if you let listeners out there know the relationship of the U.S. Social Forum to the world social forums and even more writ large, the sort of counter-neoliberal globalization movement. And then maybe also how many people participated last summer in Detroit at the U.S. Social Forum. I think it will really impress people to know that.
Thanks again, Alan, for having us on. I think that Jerome touched on most of the things, and just to sort of recap, that the U.S. Social Forum is really led by grassroots organizations and people who are really in struggle on the ground, who are really most adversely affected, whether it's around housing or youth or education or healthcare or climate justice. And so connecting that to the question of the World Social Forum, the World Forum began in 2001 in Porto Alegre, Brazil, was inspired by the Zapatista uprising in 1994 and the Battle of Seattle in 1999. And it took as its slogan or its motto or its call, Another World is Possible. And that was really to counter the notion that was being put out by elites, economic and political elites around the world, that there is no alternative. So from 2001 on, I think those of us who are listening can sort of recall that things really began to deteriorate in the end of the last century and in the first decade of this new 21st century. And so the Social Forum was really a gathering place for those people in struggle to really come together to say we really have the power if we vision and develop some collective practice to really transform our world. And for U.S. social movements who were in the social world process at the very beginning, they really weren't represented so much by grassroots and people of color and working class organizations. There were a few there, but many kind of middle class advocates and policy people from the United States were kind of, you know, representing the U.S. And so grassroots organizations came back to the United States and said, there's a powerful process going on, and we want the world to know that there is a social movement that is developing here in the U.S. that is people of color-led and grassroots-led and working class and poor people-led. And that's really the beginning of how the U.S. Social Forum came to be. We were asked to organize a U.S. process from the very beginning, from about 2003 on. And we really said it was going to take time to do the work we had to do on the ground in our communities, to have people both be able to struggle daily around, you know, gentrification, loss of jobs, loss of, you know, welfare, and so on, as well as begin to organize to be in a relationship to the social movements of the world. So, to make a long story short, we finally did a consultation and said that in 2006 we were going to have the first United States Social Forum. And it was going to be, as it was, the year later in Atlanta, Georgia. And Hurricane Katrina came and, you know, did much destruction in the Gulf Coast. And so we really argued for that part of our community to be there. We needed to put it off a year. So the very first U.S. Social Forum was in Atlanta, Georgia in 2007, where 20,000 activists and organizers, representing about 1,200 organizations, came together to declare another world is possible and another United States is necessary. The next stop was, as you said, in Detroit in the summer of 2010. And we went to Detroit because it represented really the epitome of the crisis that global capitalism was, you know, wreaking upon our communities. And in Detroit, we gathered about 25,000 organizers, movement builders, and we represented there about 2,000 organizations from across the United States and about, you know, 70 countries. So it was a very powerful force that let us know that we were not, in fact, isolated and that we were, in fact, beginning to develop some really shared practice, really beginning to think about what does it mean concretely to be against capitalism, to be against patriarchy and white supremacy, and how do we put that understanding into practice to really model and develop another world and another United States.
I'm speaking with Jerome Scott and Walda Katz-Fishman, both of whom were on the planning committee for the U.S. Social Forum 2010 in Detroit, and I imagine they're both still very active in the U.S. Social Forum. So very quickly, when do you think the next U.S. Social Forum will be, and how do people get involved and in contact with the organizations that are participated in Detroit and are continuing to participate in the United States Social Forum as it goes forward?
The next U.S. Social Forum date and place has not yet been determined. We're going to be having a National Planning Committee call sometime next week to discuss the events transpiring in Wisconsin and the rest of the Midwest. And I'm sure at that point we'll be discussing our next planning meeting to determine when the date and the place of the next U.S. Social Forum.
And I want to thank you both for joining us. This is Alan Minsky. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States, live from the Left Forum. And I've been speaking with Jerome Scott, who is the former director of Project South, the Institute for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide, a member of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, and on the National Planning Committee for the U.S. Social Forum. Walda Katz-Fishman is a sociologist at Howard University, was formerly on the board as well for Project South, and she also was on the National Planning Committee for the U.S. Social Forum. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, live from the Left Forum here in New York City. I'm your host, Alan Minsky. I want to thank producer Melisa Figueroa. I want to thank all the folks here at the Left Forum for putting together this amazing event. And back at KPFK, a shout out to Tamika Miller and producer Avriel Hillman. If you're listening to this on KPFK on Saturday, March 19th, remember to tune in tomorrow at noon on KPFK to hear another installment of Building a Powerful Left in the United States, live from the Left Forum in New York City. See you then.